The Fix Is In is the name of the book from Brian Toohey. We'll talk more about him in just a minute, but it's a fascinating argument that there are just too many interests involved in professional sports for us to pretend anymore that these outcomes are random and that they are true to the competition of sports, that these are, in many cases, fixed outcomes based on a predetermined storyline. And he'll make his argument for that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Brian Toohey has been called the nation's foremost sports conspiracy theorist, or at least amongst the many things that Brian Toohey has been called as a result of this book, The Fix Is In. Good evening, Brian Toohey.
Good evening. How are you, Ian?
Good. Other than being a skeptical sports fan, what else do you do and professionally that leaves you so informed on this subject?
Well, nothing professionally. What I've done is actually I did a lot of research. I was a former fan of professional sports, and the more I watched sports and the more I saw the sports league lying to me about the drugs in the game, criminals in the game, the gambling going on with the game, I started researching that, and I started to believe that they were lying to me then about the game itself, because that is the product. That is what they sell.
So not a sports columnist somewhere who's gone rogue?
No.
Okay. Well, fine.
Not at all. I actually worked as a screenwriter in Hollywood.
Well, that's what I was asking. Okay, so
I went from that to failing in Hollywood because it's such a tough nut to crack. Turned to book writing.
And in a way, you sort of allege screenwriting at the top of these major league sports.
Well, yeah, because I believe, because like I say, they sell their game. That's their product. And they're not selling the game anymore really to the fans in the seats. They're selling it to the people watching at home because that's where their money comes from. And that makes it more of a show business entity than anything.
You make a really compelling argument. At one point, you sort of distill it down here. I'm going to read what you wrote because I said it took me to page 160, I think, to come across like the consummate paragraph on this. And this is what you said. You said, let's assume for a moment that professional sports leagues are not just sports entities, but are mere cogs in the greater show business machine. What does that mean? It forces each league to concern itself with increasing market share while maintaining popularity with its original fan base. How can a league do this, especially when the audience has seen and heard it all before? I think that's a very interesting way of sort of distilling it. That this is, you know, they're always trying to create something new while at the same time maintaining the traditions of the old. How do you keep getting people to come back and watch a game in a way that they've seen 1,000, 10,000, a million times?
Exactly. That's the big question, because it is the same thing over and over again. I mean, like the Blackhawks just won the Stanley Cup, but a year from now, someone else is going to be playing for the Stanley Cup. It's the same thing all over again. It's just probably going to involve different teams.
Well, it will involve, yeah, very likely will involve different teams, and there'll be different players, and to some, you know, so why aren't the variables enough? Why isn't just enough to say, well, same names of teams, maybe, but really different teams, and that's enough to make people want to watch? Oh, I wonder what will happen this time.
Well, because what I found as I did research and looking into this is that every time a league needed a game or a series, it seemed like, to go their way to get more ratings, to generate more interest, the games always seemed to go that way. It was rare that you had, you know, a constant run of, like, World Series that only lasted four games, that they were sweeps, or the same in, like, the NBA Finals or in the Stanley Cup. It always seemed like it extended longer than it should have, even when you had a team that seemed dominant against a team that seemed weaker. It always seemed to go extra games, which would mean more ratings, which would mean more interest, which would mean more money, and that's what it boils down to, is these leagues are businesses, and most fans don't really look at them as businesses unless they think, you know, some player's getting jobbed and their salary is
right.
A business, and they're first and foremost, they're trying to make money, and they're trying to make money by getting people to watch their games.
We're going to get into a lot of details tonight. You've got many angles that you use to borrow your phrase from before, to crack that nut, and so let's go ahead and put that off for just a second, though, to wonder this. When you saw today's or heard about today's goal that was scored against England by the USA at the World Cup, a weak shot on goal that went dribbling past the England goalie, were you at all suspicious of that?
Instantly. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah, tell me, because I thought of you when that happened. I've been reading your book all week, and I thought of you immediately when that happened.
Well, it's interesting that another person, another author by the name of Declan Hill, he wrote a book called The Fix, Organized Crime in Soccer. And he did 5 years' worth of research, and he investigated basically game fixing in soccer that occurs worldwide. And he even went so far as to get it into he worked with the guys who fixed the game. And these guys were mostly Asian gamblers, because the Asian gambling market is actually bigger than it is in the United States and Europe combined. That's how big the Asian gambling market is, especially sports gambling. And these guys have fixed games all over the world in soccer. They fixed World Cup games, he's discovered. They fixed Olympic games, local games. These guys fixed everything. And when you look at a weird goal like that, you just wonder, did the guy just make a mistake, or did something maybe go on behind the scenes that no one really knows about?
Okay, so let's just starting with today's World Cup soccer action. And this is pure speculation. I'm not holding you to this. Nobody else should. Don't hold me to this. But if it's not just a kind of a silly mistake made by a top flight goalie, if it isn't just a brain fart there with the world watching, and he just like totally took his eye off the ball for 1 second, or as it appears in the replay, he seemed like he thought his hands were flush with the ball as it came, but his left hand was further up, and so he just, you know, by accident sort of knocked it over his own shoulder. If that isn't just that, what would be a likely scenario for how the fix would have been in on today's World Cup match?
Well, I think there's two different ways of fixing the game. A lot of what I argue in my book is that games are fixed by leagues. And in what this other guy, Declan Hill, argues in his book about soccer is that it's often fixed by gamblers, and there would be two different ways of doing it. A gambler may very well say, if they got to this goalie, say they bribed him, say they had, you know, a drug problem no one knew about, or a gambling problem no one knew about, but right, the mafia guys did, they could control him and say, hey, we need this game. He may even said, you know, we don't need you to lose, but we need you not to cover the point spread that may have been in the USA-England soccer game, because England was favored, so likely America was getting an extra goal. And if the game even ended in a tie, the gamblers would win because they were given that goal in the point spread.
Or even if the bet was America will score one goal against England.
Exactly.
They will get one goal. And all they have to do is then fix it with the goalie that says, you let in one goal. If your team wins 2-1, you win. 3-1, you win. Hey, you're England. Chances are you'll rout this team. It won't kill you to let in one goal.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because he made later on in the game, he made an incredible save, that same goalie, that almost went in, went off his hand off, I think, like the crossbar, the goal
post. No, it went off the post, yeah.
Off it was the post, but, ugh. I mean, so there was, you know, because if a normal person looks at that goal, they would say, gosh, my 6-year-old, you know, nephew could have covered that ball up.
Right.
This little league soccer game. Why didn't this professional goalie playing in, you know, the world's biggest stage not cover that ball up?
Right.
Yeah, like you say, it could just been, maybe it's just an accident. Maybe the guy just choked, froze up, whatever, but then again, maybe not.
There's precedent. If he did let the goal in, there is precedent for that.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And so it is, too, here in the United States, that there are and let's get down to some of the most famous cases of this. You think that there's a fix that comes down from the top, and I'll leave it up to you to explain how, in famous games like at the time, the Baltimore Colts versus the New York Jets, the old classic NFL franchise versus the new upstart league in the Super Bowl. Why do you think the fix was in on that Super Bowl game?
Because there was tons of money involved in that. And what it came down to is the AFL, which was a separate league from the NFL, were merging. and they are basically merging into one league at the end of that season. And at the time, a lot of NFL fans, because it was the longer existing league, did not accept the AFL and the talent that was in that league. Even though perhaps they were maybe more equal than people thought, the public perception was that the NFL was much mightier league than the AFL, and it would almost be like if the XFL, the league that was started and lasted like 1 year, suddenly decided to join the NFL, a lot of NFL fans would say, well, there's no way we can accept the XFL. And that was kind of the same feeling back then. And so what the league, I believe, did was say, what we need to prove it to the fans that the AFL is equal to the NFL is in this third Super Bowl after we had Green Bay demolish the AFL teams in Super Bowls 1 and 2. We need an AFL team to beat the NFL team in Super Bowl 3 here to bring some credibility to their league. And they had a star quarterback in Joe Namath for the Jets playing in that game. And it was just a great scenario that it could, if they could fix that game, if they could rig it and get the Jets to win, perhaps it would make this merger a lot easier. It would get fans in, and it would draw TV ratings, and the league would just go from there.
What's the precedent? What's the proof that there has been fixing going on in professional football? There's whole libraries of movies written about fixing in professional baseball, but what about football?
Well, football, there are games that have been fixed by, like, mafia members. Now, the interesting thing is if you ask the NFL directly, you'd go to their commissioner right now and say, how many games have been fixed, NFL games have been fixed ever, their answer would be zero. But the truth is, another investigative reporter by the name of Dan Waldea, he wrote in a book, Interference, that he could prove at least 70 NFL games have been fixed by gamblers or mafia members. And I have a stack up in my office right now of FBI files investigating similar claims. And so if you know you can fix a football game, in fact, I can't remember the year, it was an early 1950s football game that was probably attempted to be rigged between, I think it was the Giants and the Chicago Bears. Maybe it was 1946, I believe, actually, that was attempted to be rigged, and they caught it right as it was kind of happening, and it maybe it did go down that fix of the game. But if the mafia can fix a game, then clearly the NFL, who has more power and control over the players, could easily fix a game the same way the mafia does.
Now, how would they fix it? And how is it that they would be able to, all these years later, be able to keep that cat from getting out of the bag?
Well, that's two big questions. One is, how would they fix it? One of the easiest ways to fix it is people are greedy. You could easily bribe them. I mean, even in this day and age, you know, you look at people with multi-million dollar contracts. Well, not every athlete gets that kind of money.
Well, certainly not back then. A lot of them had part-time jobs.
Back then, it was very easy to bribe, just flat-out bribe a guy. Hey, I'll double your salary, basically, if you throw this one game. Well, sure, for, you know, an hour's worth of work or 3 hours worth of work, yeah, why not? But
right.
In this day and age, I mean, you can do it almost through blackmail as well.
Well, and then what about this? I mean, just the, and this isn't, I'm not saying this is true for the Colts Jets game, but we do know that people like Paul Hornig, he was betting on games in which he was playing, right?
Oh, exactly. And of course, he's always betting for his own team, which doesn't make a lot of sense, because if you're betting to win, you know, you could do as much as you wanted to, and that wouldn't necessarily cause your team to win, but you know you could probably, especially him being the star of the Packers at the time, you could do a lot less than your normal and make sure your team loses. But, of course, his claim is that he always bet on his team to win, and other players supposedly did the same, but only him and Alex Karras were the only two NFL players to ever be suspended by the league for gambling on football.
But the interesting part of that is, who do you go to for verification of that, you know? I mean,
well, exactly. Because it's all illegal gambling.
Yeah, you can't go to Johnny the Nose down the corner and say, hey, can you come in and just say he only bet on the games to win? I mean, of course he's going to say that. And I'm not saying he didn't. I mean, but it opens up, as soon as you're getting in with gamblers, it does open up the possibility that you could get thrown and then turn around and throw a game. But what's interesting to me about that is what the quote is from Paul Hornig, and he said that if I wasn't gambling, I wouldn't have made any money at all. His income came from gambling on his own games because he wasn't getting paid squat.
Well, the funny thing was, he wasn't getting paid by the NFL squad or by the Packers, but At the same time, he was actually making a lot of money in endorsement deals because he was a big prominent figure. He was getting endorsement deals, I think, from like a leisure wear company, and I think even like a car company for doing advertising. So he wasn't as broke as he made it sound. In fact, in his book, he has a lot of contradictory stories about how much he was gambling or how much he was winning or not winning. But he obviously was gambling, and he clearly admits he was.
But it does go back to your premise then. If you ask the NFL how many games have ever been fixed, they would say zero, which tells you right away, okay, they have a corporate interest in maintaining that image, but is it the truth? And if they're not telling the truth, then how could they be trusted?
Exactly. And the thing is, too, the NFL and all these sports leagues are self-regulated entities. There's no oversight on them. They control everything. They control the investigations into their own game. Well, if they find, like if in baseball, steroids was in baseball, that Major League Baseball investigated themselves for steroids. Well, they could say as many or as few players were taking the steroids as they wanted to because who was looking over their shoulder? No one.
Right. And they didn't invite anybody else in to do an independent investigation.
No.
They had
And
to
why would
control
they?
the
They
out, they
didn't.
had to control the outcome on that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about steroids in baseball because I think you make a very interesting point. Again, we're talking with Brian Toohey, the author of The Fix Is In: The Showbiz Manipulations of the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. And we'll get to all of these as we go along. Is that you have a time when Major League Baseball needed it most. They got a home run surge after the strike-shortened season that engendered such ill will amongst American baseball, professional baseball fans. Suddenly, the bats came alive. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, in 1994, baseball had a lockout, which caused the cancellation of the rest of the series, and the World Series was played, which was the first time that happened in 90 years. And many fans and people I know said, I'll never watch baseball again now. I'm done with it. That just ruined it for me. And then all of a sudden, coming right out of the chute the next year, players started hitting home runs at an incredible pace. And it didn't seem natural compared to the stats that had followed the 90 years or so of history. But suddenly, these guys like Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa started hitting 60 home runs, breaking home run records. And along came Barry Bonds, and he started hitting home runs at an incredible pace. And everybody in baseball looked the other way as this was happening. Nobody questioned how, in God's name, that 61 home runs have been the benchmark forever for a season. How are these guys suddenly breaking this record season after season?
And not just one, we're leaving out Ken Griffey Jr. You got four.
Well, Ken Griffey Jr., but I don't think Junior was involved in the whole steroid thing. I think he was
Well,
one of
maybe
the
not. I'm just
serious
saying.
athletes, but
But
yeah, there
look at.
was more guys who were doing it than just these three. But even then, like I said, no one in baseball was questioning it. Nobody was going, well, how is this possible? How come these guys, when they came up as rookies, looked, rail thin, and now they're these big muscle men and they're hitting the ball farther than we've ever seen before. And no, like I say, the Baseball Writers of America, which pat themselves on the back for keeping Pete Rose out of the Hall of Fame for gambling on the game, they didn't say anything about steroids. They
And
apparently
they were
like.
looking at evidence of it. They were, it was, the evidence was staring them in the face.
Yeah. And they knew,
Okay.
I mean, they talk to these guys every day. They see them in spring training. They see them, after the season. They're involved innately with the game. And they didn't even, I mean, you didn't even have to accuse a player. You could have just written a general article about steroids being in the game, and none of them even seemed to do that.
Are you a Chicago sports fan?
To some degree, yeah.
Okay. It's not just the accent, but I like how you were referencing a couple of these Chicago games, which I've known pretty well over the years. But you get them all in The Fix Is In: The Showbiz Manipulations of the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. We've talked just a little bit. We talked about soccer. We talked a little bit about football. We'll get back to more about Major League Baseball and some of the very famous fixes of Major League Baseball. But lesser known fixes of the NBA and the NHL. And then we'll talk about NASCAR too. It's fascinating. Coming up tomorrow night, I'll be hosting Coast to Coast. The subject will be the oil spill. And in particular, one aspect of it is whether or not the oil is running out or whether we've got, this is proof we've got plenty of oil down there yet to go on our planet. That's tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. There have been some. We know some happen for sure. I mean, there's no dispute. And in every sport, there have been some people who have admitted to fixing outcomes. But Brian Toohey says the evidence is there that indicates this goes much deeper than what people have confessed to. And in fact, it's in the league's best interest to look the other way on what they know is going on. And in some ways, to write the scenarios themselves for how these series are supposed to work out, and that they can affect those outcomes all the way from the home office of whatever major league sports we're talking about. Coming up, we'll explore that. We'll go to the NBA next, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking with Brian Toohey, the author of The Fixes in the Showbiz Manipulations of the NFL, MLB, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. Let's talk a little bit about basketball. And since you had mentioned some famous Chicago games in your book, or referenced some great Chicago controversies, there's one that I felt from the second I saw it, it looked like a fixed outcome, not just a bad call, but it looks like a fixed outcome. Maybe even know where I'm going with this. In that famous season after Michael Jordan left to play baseball, and the Bulls were playing the Knicks, and Hugh Hollins, the NBA official, called Scottie Pippen on a foul in the final seconds of the game, which gave the Knicks two free throws. They were down by 1 point. They missed the shot. He called a late foul on Scottie Pippen, who was nowhere, didn't even touch the other player, sent him to the free throw. Hubert Davis, I think it was, sent him to the free throw line. He shoots two free throws. Knicks win. And then they go on to play in the NBA Finals. But that looked like such a fixed call. It was just such – you almost never see that. And at the time, everybody's saying, what, is he a guy on the take? I mean, is he got mob debts? And it wasn't too many years after that before we find out that, yes, in fact, there are NBA referees who are upside down in debt to the mob and make bad calls to help even things out. Where are you with all that?
It's a long story.
Okay.
Well, it's the main thing is people have always wanted a whistleblower for this type of thing to say, okay, well, if you think sports are fixed, where's the inside guy who proves this is true? And like you said, we just recently had Tim Donaghy, who was a 13-year NBA referee, get busted by the FBI for working with mafia gamblers and betting on games. Now, Donaghy claims that he never fixed a game. He only provided inside information, and he knew enough about the relationship between the NBA, the referees, and its players that he could predict accurately, I think 80% of the time, according to records, who would win and how they could gamble and make money on that. And I find that a little hard to believe. I find that even though they gambled on games that he refereed, he says he never fixed them, but I don't know why he wouldn't. Because he has the ability to do so, and if you're going to bet on the game you're involved in, why wouldn't you make sure you won?
Well, and statistically, I mean, the numbers were run that said that the odds were against the idea that he, in the games that he officiated, at the time they said that the point spread was covered like 20% or 25% more often in games that he officiated, in games that he didn't. And that like the same run of teams the year before, or the same run of games the year before, resulted in a much fewer percentage of teams covering the point spread. And so it would seem as though he helped to make sure that teams covered the point spread, if nothing. If he didn't fix the outcome, he made sure they had a couple extra points to cover the point spread. So he could say legitimately, I never decided who won or lost, but he can't say statistically that he didn't influence by what percentage they won.
Well, and that's the hard thing with this whole game fixing thing is the proof of it all. Is if he can say, you know, I didn't fix the game, it's up to then to the NBA, or in this case, even the FBI, to prove that he did. And how do you prove it? How do you say, well, like you said in that case with Scottie Pippen and the Knicks, how do you prove that wasn't just a bad call by human error, or that it was, in fact, intentional.
Right.
And that's what the FBI exactly ran into when they're investigating him, is he said he didn't do it. They have to prove otherwise. Well, how do you prove that? I mean, how much game film can you watch and say, well, yeah, he should have called that, I guess. I guess he should have. Maybe he shouldn't have. I don't know. And that's what I've talked with an actual FBI agent who is retired now after serving 30 years, who investigated some of these game, these sports bribery cases. And they said proof is the hardest thing to find because nobody writes down, you know, what their deal is. It's all verbal. And there is no proof. There is no concrete evidence that these things happened unless they got a wiretap and got, you know, these guys in, you know, in red-handed, basically, fixing the game, or if they got someone to squeal, they couldn't prove half the time that these games were fixed.
Okay, but there you go. As you said, they were looking for an inside man. So here's the same guy, Tim Donaghy, that's his name, right? He said that in 2008, I mean, he was willing to let go on the record. He was willing to, one of the games between the Lakers and the Kings was fixed by two referees.
Well, exactly. When he got busted by the FBI, he then basically turned against the NBA and said, all right, if you guys are going to take me down, I'm going to tell you all the dirty dealings that go on in the NBA. And he went a couple things through his lawyer, these kind of veiled letters about games that he believed were fixed by the NBA through the referees to ensure that games and series went longer and that certain teams won over other teams. And one of the most famous ones that he pointed to was the 2002 conference finals between the Lakers and the Sacramento Kings.
And what was at stake? What was it? What was the fix in by the NBA for that year?
Well, for the NBA wanted the Kings were winning 3-2. They wanted it to see it go to a game seven because it would draw more interest. And I believe they wanted the Lakers to go on to the NBA finals because it's a much bigger market television wise than Sacramento would be. And the Lakers had more stars. They had, you know, the Kobe Bryant and everything going for them.
So how do they fix it?
What's that?
So how do they fix it then to make sure it goes to seven?
They basically called as many fouls as they possibly could against the Sacramento Kings in game six. In fact, it's been called by sports commentators the worst officiated NBA game ever because there was such a one-sided, lopsided calls against the Kings. They were calling fouls on things that, you know, weren't even close to being fouls. And it cost the Kings the game. Then they lost game seven, and they were done.
You know, you would think that it would be in the NBA's best interest to prove that that's not true. And yet, as far as I know, it's gone unchallenged other than they said, oh, that's not true. But, I mean, it's not like they open up the books. It's not like they pull back the curtain and invite people in to interview all the people. And to, they just basically say it's not true, and then that's it. I mean, and because of the corporate interests when the broadcasting, who's going to do the investigation? And if you're going to do the investigation, don't you need to have the videotape in order to make, say, the TV documentary? And I doubt the NBA is going to give them the TV, the rights to the broadcast in order for them to make a documentary about how the fix was in.
Well, exactly. And one of the things, like when the whole Tim Donaghy story broke, is the people who should have been investigating, like you said, they didn't. One of the biggest ones should have been ESPN. But why didn't ESPN investigate Tim Donaghy and his claims against the NBA? Because at that very same time, ESPN is paying the NBA $900 million a season to broadcast their games. So are they going to investigate a claim by a former referee who would still be a current referee if it wasn't for the FBI? Not that the NBA would have kicked Donaghy out. It was only because he got busted by the FBI that he was out. Would ESPN investigate that and potentially shoot themselves and their $900 million in the foot by claiming that the league's rigged?
Tim Donaghy, the whistleblowing referee, if you'll pardon the pun, he said that there were certain refs that were reprimanded for calling technical fouls, and in one case, a referee got reprimanded for throwing a player out of a game, even though by all rights the player deserved it, but because the player was a star and the NBA didn't want him thrown out in the first quarter or something, or first half.
Yeah, well, the NBA, they market their stars over their team. It's usually Kobe Bryant and the Lakers. It's not the LA Lakers. It's Kobe Bryant and the Lakers. So it's always Michael Jordan and the Bulls. It's always their stars. Their stars comes first, and that's what they market. And so, yeah, they want to keep their stars in the game as long as possible and give them as much room to operate and do their thing because they feel that's what draws in the fans. That's what keeps people interested.
Okay, and then what happened to his book? Wasn't Donaghy going to write a book, and that was due out last year or this year,
He did write, yeah,
and it
he
got
did write a
spiked?
book. Yeah, it got pulled. I don't remember who the publisher was. It might have been Random House originally that was going to publish it. It was a bigger company. I think it was the division of Random House. I think it was like Triumph Books or something like that. They
okay.
got pulled right at the last minute. It got pulled for nobody knows exactly the reason. They just claimed
okay.
that they didn't want to release it. And then it wound up did getting released by another publisher. And then it went through another series of legal issues between Donaghy and that publisher. So there's some controversy even now as to what's going on with that book.
I don't know. I'd be kind of curious to see whether I could get him as a guest on Coast to Coast. I think it's very interesting. All right, so
oh, I'm sure you could. And the interesting thing I think about refereeing is there's no law that stops a referee from making a bad call or, you know, making a call at all. And it's one of the biggest things I think that kind of almost helps prove that this is very possible is there is no law that prevents the NBA from fixing their own games.
That prevents the NBA from fixing their own games.
Yes, there's a
right.
law. If a gambler fixed a game, it's sports bribery. That's against the law. If I paid a player to fix a game for gambling purposes, that's against the law. And from the quiz show scandals in the 50s, it's against the law to rig a televised contest of an intellectual nature. But there's nothing against fixing a physical contest. There's
oh,
no
so
law. The only thing people have told me is supposedly it might fall under some category of fraud. But at the same time, now recently the NFL was just sued by a fan, a Jets fan, over the whole Spygate incident with the New England Patriots, where the Patriots coaches were caught red-handed taping the opposing coaches' signals.
Right.
That to their advantage. So a Jets fan, who happened to be a lawyer, of course, wound
right.
up turning around and suing the Patriots for doing that. And the case got to an appeals court. And in the appeals court, the judge threw it out and said, here's the thing. He goes, at best, and basically his quote was, at best, what your ticket provides you is the ability to see a football game. And that's it. And at the same time, the
not NFL, an honest football game, not
no,
a pure, just a
game.
Football game. That's all you're paying for, and you got it. You
yeah.
asked to see a football game, and you got it.
And even worse is the NFL lawyers argued in that case. They argued that if fans knew that the Patriots were cheating, if they knew Spygate was occurring, they would have still bought tickets to see those games.
Hmm.
So basically, the lawyer for the guy who was suing the Patriots said, well, then if that's all true, then you know what? The NFL could be as rigged as professional wrestling and get away with it. I said, you know, you should have been reading my book because that's exactly the argument I make.
Right. Again, the book is The Fix Is In. We're talking with Brian Toohey, a skeptical sports fan and called by some like ESPN as the nation's foremost sports conspiracist. But you back up. Obviously, you do your research, dude. I mean, you got it. I really you lay it out there. Let's talk about that Game 7 phenomenon, about the statistical average of series that should go to seven games. And then I want to get into NASCAR coming up. So talk about this. What is it, you know, that they've run the numbers on this, and series shouldn't go to game seven as often as they do?
No, they should not. And there was a study done by a guy for the Rand Corporation, and he was a statistician by the name of Hembold was his last name. And he did a study in the late 1960s called Have the World Series Been Fixed? And his question was, had the World Series basically gone to Game 7 more often than it should have? And he said it obviously would behoove the league if that happened because, like I argue in my book, it would mean more money for the league, it'd be more money for the advertisers, everybody would profit from it going longer than it technically should have. So he ran the numbers, and in the 1960s, through his high-minded math, which I can't even get into, he
right.
figured that in the 1967 and 68 World Series, that yes, indeed, through his statistical analysis, game seven had been occurring more often than it should have. And I took it and went, well, the first televised World Series was 1949. And between 1949 and 1989, out of those 40 years, 20 of the World Series had gone to game seven. Statistically half, and that should not be.
So the argument is made that somewhere down the line, umpires are given the nod to say, hey, you know, look the other way on this, or this is the team we want to win. And if they're good company men, if they're good corporate men, they just go, they don't have to hear. It's kind of like how a mobster might say, you know, it really bothers me that that guy's still alive. That's all he has to say. He doesn't say, somebody go out and shoot him. He just has to say, I wish he were dead. And that gives them sort of the plausible deniability. That's sort of the same thing you could even say in the NBA. The word comes down from the top. They sure like this one to go to seven games, or boy, it'd be great if the major market team makes it into the broadcast finals.
Well, that's exactly what Donahue said. He said it wasn't, you know, they didn't come in there and say, you must make this happen. It was all just kind of alluded to and, you know, just kind of said offhandedly, but everybody knew what it meant.
And that you would get complimented if it went the way that the league wanted it to go.
Well, and the referees make more money, too, because someone determines who the referees are for those playoff games and for the finals. And if you're a referee in the finals, you make a lot more money than you did in the playoffs and than you did in the regular season. So time it benefits them to, you know, if they follow the company line, maybe they'll get rewarded with that finals call.
Very interesting. Now, we'll get more into NASCAR coming up in just a second, but I don't understand the corporate structure of NASCAR so much. So I'm not, when I was reading your chapter on NASCAR, I was really, this was whole new territory for me. And one or two of these stories I had heard of, I mean, because I follow NASCAR to a point. I mean, I'm interested in it, but I don't really know it like I know some of the other major sports. So just give sort of an overview before we get into some of the specifics, because the specifics are fascinating, on how it would be that NASCAR could get fixed with all the variables that go into a stock car race.
Well, NASCAR is unusual because it's actually a privately owned company, unlike the NFL, which is a collection of 32 teams, which they like to say are 32 individual teams, but just went to the Supreme Court to argue that they're actually one entity. NASCAR is a family-owned business. And then from there, it goes down to the individual teams who race for that individual business, which is unlike any of the other professional sports leagues out there.
Who owns NASCAR?
It's the France family, I believe. And they actually own, like, the Daytona track. And they own a few other tracks, which ones I can't say off the top of my head, but they own a few other tracks as well. And they make most of the money when NASCAR races.
And so they are the ones that give out the end. I mean, they're the ones that do the sponsorships. There's the ones that arrange for these teams, you know, these racing teams to compete. Do you have to pay them money to get the privilege to race in NASCAR?
You know, honestly, I do not know. How you get into the NASCAR inner circle, but it's not too many people who do.
Okay, it will involve money. It will involve money flowing up and not money flowing down. I'm certain. All right, but we'll get into that. The fix is in the showbiz manipulations of the NFL, MLB, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. What Brian Toohey does have in the book are some fascinating examples of how cars have been juiced like a major league, you know, slugger juiced, or how bats got fixed. You can do the same thing with cars, and only sometimes do they get caught. And when they get caught, of course, it's always the lowest level person that did it. It's always the person lowest on the ladder, the chain of authority, that was responsible for the fix, or at least they're the person that gets punished for it. We'll tell you about some of these outrageous examples of when the fix is in NASCAR coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.